Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll, and today we're going to be talking about heredity. This is, of course, a very old idea, the idea that there's something inside us, some properties, some features that get passed down through the generations. So we inherited something from our ancestors, and we send something down to our descendants. Back in the day, there used to be the thought that royal blood was handed down, that the right to be the king or the queen or the emperor depended on who your parents were. I suppose there's still countries in which that is the case. But we know a lot more about how heredity really works now than we used to. We know that all of our cells have a little molecule in them called DNA, and that DNA is a little code. It's a chain of letters, A, G, C, T, that the arrangement of those letters tells us what makes up who we are. Or at least there's a simplistic version of it where you think of DNA as kind of like a blueprint, that if you knew what the DNA was, you could predict exactly what the organism was going to be, maybe even, you know, what kind of food they would like or what kind of occupation they would have later in life. Today, we know it's a little bit more complicated than that. There's more going on than just our DNA to make up who we are. Not only nature versus nurture, but even the nature part is very complicated. There's epigenetics and development factors. There's mitochondrial DNA. There's the expression of different parts of the genes that we have. And so we're in a very, very rapid state of evolution, as it were, in terms of how we think about how heredity works. These days, you can get your genome sequenced, you can send it into a company, pay some money, and they'll tell you something about your genetic heritage. On the horizon, we see the ability to edit genes. We can do it in some ways now, and the ability to do that for human beings probably is not very far away. So it's natural to imagine, you know, can we design what the next generation of human beings is going to be like? Can we design the animals and plants that make up the rest of our ecosystem? These are important questions as well as fascinating ones. So we have today Carl Zimmer as our guest. Carl is one of the very best science writers working out there. He's been working and writing about this area of genetics and heredity and DNA for a very long time. You may know Carl through his blogging or his Twitter account, his New York Times column, or you may have heard him on NPR. Now Carl has a major new book out called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. It's a doorstopper. It's a big one, but it's full of fascinating individual human stories as well as the deep science behind what we know about heredity. So we're going to talk about how heredity works, what we do and don't know about it, and most importantly, where the new knowledge that we're gaining every day might take us. It seems very plausible that what we're learning these days might dramatically change how we think about being human beings. So let's go. We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Carl Zimmer, welcome to the Mindscape Podcast.
It's great to talk to you.
So now we've known each other virtually, at least online, you know, since the early halcyon salad days of the blogging world, right? Isn't that how I got to know you, reading your blog and you read mine?
Absolutely, yeah. Back when blogs were the future.
Blog, yes. Now we're in the future and no one writes blogs anymore.
they delivered us here.
Exactly. The future is a journey, you know, that's, and we've been through the future and now we're in the post future. So I couldn't help you've written this gigantic magisterial book about heredity, inheritance. She has her mother's laugh, and the subtitle, of course, The Power, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. And while reading it, I can't help but think, as a physicist, you know, my goodness, how lucky I am that what I do for a living doesn't really matter to people's lives. Because this is a kind of science that everyone has feelings about, right? Does that come through in your work?
Oh, I think that everybody clings to heredity in a profound way. And I see that when I give talks about my book. I mean, I have learned to keep my prepared remarks fairly short because people just have tons of questions. And the questions come from the fact that we use heredity to define who we are and also what is our connection both to the past and to the future. I mean, you can't ask for anything more intimate than that.
Yeah. So the future in terms of our children, our descendants, you mean?
Sure, absolutely. And also, like, what if we tamper with the heredity of other species? And, you know, then what, right. what is left after we're gone? Well, you know, heredity will carry on those sorts of changes into the future.
So I think, you know, everyone who is involved in this conversation right now knows a little bit, right? You know, we're not entering and we're not telling people something that they've never heard before, that there's something called DNA in our cells and it carries some information. So let's try to remember what it was like before we knew that, right? People still had an idea of inheritance and heredity and things being passed down through the blood even before Darwin and Mendel came along.
Right. I mean, it's kind of hard to reconstruct the way people thought in the past, especially when they didn't use the concepts and the words that we use today. And yet, you know, we can start to get some clues about it just by looking back and trying to piece together. You know, for example, there were ideas about blood, as you say. You know, we still use the word blood to talk about, you know, mm-hmm. what we really mean by genes. You know, there's the blue blood, for example. You know, like, blue blood is something that is like, well, you come from a blue blood family. In other words, somehow like that is inherited down through the generations, your sort of status. I mean, the irony is, of course, that the phrase actually comes from a particular time in a particular place. It was in Spain in the 1500s. When people in Spain were trying to distinguish themselves from Jews and Muslims. So right. this is where the whole issue of race comes from. I mean, literally the word race starts to be used in Spain in this way. And so, you know,
when are we talking? What century you said?
1500s, okay. 1400s and into 1500s. And So the idea with blue blood was that if you were, you know, racially pure, then someone could see your veins through your translucent skin. And so, you know, you can kind of get these ideas about how in Western society there were these ways in which we started to define ourselves as being sort of made up of something that was being passed down through the generations. But, you know, it wasn't until the 1800s that people like Charles Darwin actually like framed it as a scientific question. Like, okay, there's something molecular that is being passed down through the generations and explains why people have these traits that seem to run in families. So what is it?
So, yeah, I mean, Darwin wouldn't have said the word molecular, right? But we know what you mean. There is something that is being given from parents to children. But without genes, without DNA or anything like that, with this basic idea that we inherit from our mothers and our fathers, did anyone ever wonder about the fact that why aren't we always just exactly halfway in between our mothers and our fathers in every trait? There clearly seem to be variations around that. Do people in pre-Mendel and DNA worry about this fact?
Yeah, they could see for themselves that these patterns of heredity were not simple. They really puzzled over them. Mendel was just in a long line of people who are scratching their heads. And, you know, these were plant breeders. These were animal breeders. In the 1700s, someone named Bakewell in England became legendary because he created a new breed of sheep. And he did it by carefully breeding different kinds of sheep together and coming up with these sort of rules of his own for how to breed them. And it was an incredible accomplishment, you know, because, you know, people would breed animals and, you know, like their offspring would be all sort of a mess. They would be like, right, you know, all this variation when, you know, if you're breeding animals, you want them all to be the same. You know, if you want a particular kind of meat from an animal, you want them all to have that same taste. You want a kind of wool, you want the same wool. So it was a huge puzzle and struggle, and the stakes were enormous. I mean, you know, by the 1700s and 1800s, countries were actually looking at breeding, in other words, heredity, as part of their national wealth. You know, if you could breed new crops and new livestock, you were going to make your country rich.
I love the practicality of it. It reminds me of, you know, how thermodynamics, which can be a very abstract and theoretical subject, arose from trying to get better steam engines, right? You know, this was definitely an era where there was a give and take between people with boots on the ground trying to make better products and trying to understand the world better as scientists.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, because, you know, we assume that everybody must have thought about heredity the way we do and wondered about it the way we do 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, but they just didn't. And it wasn't really until some practical questions drove people to really think carefully about this. And, you know, the other people, in addition to breeders, were psychiatrists. In the early 1800s, particularly in France and also to some extent the United States and elsewhere, psychiatrists were trying to understand madness. And then they were struck by the fact that when they would do questionnaires for their patients often had people in their family or more distant relatives who also were institutionalized, or, you know, maybe they had, you know, something that seemed like a form of madness. And so they said, so is this a hereditary disease? And if so, how on earth could this be passed down through the generations? And right. So Darwin actually read a lot of psychiatry when he was developing his own ideas about heredity.
So this connection between heredity and intelligence and madness and thought was there from the very, very beginning.
Yeah. A lot of the things that we're talking about right now, people were talking about 150 or 200 years ago with just as much loudness and passion and conflict.
Maybe not just as much, because now we have Twitter and they didn't have that there. So that's an amplifier that they didn't have.
Yeah, but they had pamphlets, you know, like a lot of this stuff would get circulated in things like pamphlets where, you know, you get a new pamphlet every day. Like I feel like Twitter is just an extension of the old traditions of pamphlets.
So maybe blogging is the past more than the future.
There you go. I don't know where podcasting fits in, though.
So then we did get to genetics, right? To real genetics, to Mendel. Mendel, by the way, I have to always say this. I went to an Augustinian university, Villanova, and Augustinians have a slight inferiority complex compared to the Jesuits, who are, you know, wonderfully intellectually, have this wonderful intellectual tradition. But we have two really important Augustinians in history. One was Gregor Mendel, and the other was Martin Luther. So they weren't always, you know, the best Catholics, but they did affect the world in an important way. So Mendel, among other things, he helped sort of pinpoint this discreteness, right, of heredity, that there could be like, you get this feature or you don't. So there must be somehow, it wasn't just a blending of your two parents. There was some piece of information, a quantum, a physicist would call it, that's being handed down through the generations.
Right. Mendel didn't call them genes. Sometimes the terms he used get translated as factors. So mm-hmm. There would be some kind of factor that was in a plant. And there was an almost mathematical beauty to how these factors combined in new offspring and then produced a trait. So just what, you know, an example that people may recall from high school is that peas can be wrinkled or they can be smooth. And if you cross two wrinkled pea plants together, you're going to get nothing but wrinkled peas. If you cross two smooth peas together, you might get nothing but smooth peas. And then the next generation after that, smooth peas and smooth peas forever. On the other hand, if you cross a smooth pea and a smooth pea together, you might be surprised to suddenly have a quarter of the peas being wrinkled. And so the fact is that that wrinkled factor can hide because it's what we would now call, well, actually Mendel called it too, recessive. So so that was the first recognition that there was a thinking about heredity with these two kind of distinct parts, the invisible factors that get carried on through the generations, and then sort of what you see, what scientists call the phenotype.
This episode of Mindscape is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? Nap, go for a run, read a book? A lot of us ask these questions, wishing we had more time. But the question is, time for what? If you had unlimited time, how would you use it? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. And if you're thinking about therapy, BetterHelp is a great way to start. What I like about BetterHelp is it's so easy to start. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindscape today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindscape. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel is the science-based language learning app that actually works. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations in a series of quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I'm going to be traveling to France for the first time in a long time very soon, and Babbel's helped me reconnect with how to speak to merchants, how to order food, without having to consult a language app. Here's a special limited-time deal for Mindscape listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/mindscape. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/mindscape, spelled BABBEL.com/mindscape. Rules and restrictions may apply. And then we started finally figuring it out. We're moving quickly through the history here because I want to get to the modern world. But it wasn't until the 20th century that we were able to identify these genes as being carried by this wonderful molecule, the DNA, and Watson and Crick, et cetera. And by that time, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was already this new synthesis of genetics and evolutionary biology, natural selection, Darwin. And so the DNA was just sort of figuring out, not just, but it was figuring out what the mechanism of that was.
That's a beautiful distillation of like 80 years of really rough science. Yes, exactly. Yeah. People had known about DNA really since the 1800s, but they were kind of like, what is this weird stuff? And
just to make that very clear, they knew that there was a molecule called DNA.
Exactly. If you pulled apart cells, you would find different components. So you'd find some molecules that are known as proteins that all had a similar chemical composition. And then you would find this stuff that they called nucleic acid. And people just didn't really know what it was for, you know. And right. And actually, you know, even in the mid 1900s, a lot of people thought proteins were what genes were made of. It took some elegant experiments to demonstrate, no, actually, it's really, if you transfer DNA from one microbe to another, you transfer that trait. The proteins don't matter. And so then once we figured out the structure of DNA, then all of a sudden we can get down to the molecular details of how genes make heredity possible. In other words, that it's almost like genes are like texts. You know, they're right. They're made up of these units that where they're like letters made up from a four-letter alphabet. And we have, you know, over 3 billion letters in our DNA, and change the letters or cut and paste chunks of text, and you get changes to us. And those changes can be passed down if the DNA is being faithfully copied.
Right. And so 3 billion base pairs, right, in the human DNA. But we talk about only having like 20,000 genes. So I'm going to ask every biologist I ever talked to on the podcast to explain this, because it took me a long while to get it right.
Yeah.
But explain the relationship between the base pairs in the DNA and what we call genes.
Yeah, it's kind of messy, but you know, biology is messy.
Yeah.
So the way that people traditionally think about genes is a stretch of DNA that encodes a protein. So, you know, every protein is encoded by a gene. It is true, although sometimes you get proteins that are made by combining genes together and all sorts of stuff we don't need to get into. But in any case, we have, as you say, 20,000 of these protein coding genes. And they only make up about 1% or so, 1 or 2% of the human genome. So then the big question is, well, what's all the other stuff?
Yes.
And yeah. So some of it, you know, maybe 10% of it, has functions of its own. So actually some of them are also genes. It's just that they don't go the full process towards making proteins. You have thousands of genes, we don't know how many, that actually encode RNA molecules.
Okay.
So you may be used to thinking of RNA as part of the process to make protein. You got
right.
a gene,
so
a DNA.
RNA, yeah. Go ahead.
You got a gene, made a DNA. You make a copy in RNA, which is a single-stranded version of DNA, basically. And then you use that RNA as a template for building proteins out of a different set of molecules called
right.
amino acids. And that's true. But it turns out that sometimes our cells will make an RNA molecule and then that's it. And that not only that's it, but that RNA molecule has a really important job to do. So for example, in women have two X chromosomes. They need to keep one of them shut off, or they're going to basically poison themselves with too many proteins from the X chromosome. Men only have one X chromosome. So there are these RNA molecules that basically wrap around the X chromosome, one of the X chromosomes in women, and silence it. And so, you know, we know that at least some of these RNA molecules play an important job. So those are more genes, but that still leaves you with a lot of the rest of the genome. So some of that DNA is really important as kind of genetic switches for turning on and off genes elsewhere in the genome.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest, you know, a lot of it is probably what scientists would scientifically call junk. A lot of them are dead genes. They're genes that have mutated and just are useless now, and we just carry them along. Some of them are actually descend from viruses. So viruses infect our DNA and make copies of themselves that get passed down just spread all over our genome and bulk it up with all sorts of stuff that we don't actually use.
They also could be codes that were injected by aliens millions of years ago to be activated at some point in the future, right?
Yeah, right. Now, I haven't seen the papers on that yet, but maybe you've seen a preprint.
I'm giving you jewels here, Carl. You should write the paper.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to have the scoop of the century.
But it's a good reminder that, you know, we're not intelligently designed. The cell is kind of a mess that has been put together over billions of years. And DNA doesn't care that its job is to encode genes into proteins. It does whatever it wants to do, or whatever it needs to do to make things function. So some of the DNA is making proteins, some of it's making RNA that will do something, some of it's just going along for the ride because it keeps getting copied all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe, but the cell is a lot sloppier than we think of it as being. You know, a lot of DNA actually is used by our cells to produce RNA molecules. And then the cell just immediately shreds all that RNA because those were just sort of accidental. They were just not, they didn't really have any function. So you can have junk DNA shooting off RNA molecules, but like they don't serve any purpose. So they just, you know, the cell just sort of like manages this chaos, you know, by having certain proteins that kind of go around and say like, are you supposed to be here? And, you know, if not, then they just shred them and just recycle it to make more RNA molecules. So, if you really get to know cells, intelligent design becomes kind of laughable.
And so, okay. So we have this idea that the coding parts, there are parts of the DNA, stretches of DNA, many, many base pairs at once that will code into a protein. There's probably an informal and incorrect idea. I'm sure none of our extremely sophisticated and well-educated Mindscape listeners would have this idea, but some people might think that there's a direct map from a gene to a trait, to, you know, how big our nose are, what color our hair is, or how, you know, charismatic we are. But it's more complicated than that, right?
For the most part, yeah, it is more complicated. I mean, you know, it's good to learn about Mendel in high school, but, you know, I do think that it's going to be important for schools to take students beyond Mendel now that people are getting their DNA tested by companies like 23andMe. You can't really understand those test results if you're just relying on pea-plant experiments.
Right.
You know, your blood type, sure. It's like, you know, there's one gene and there are different versions of the gene and that can determine your blood type. Okay, no problem. But for most of the traits that we actually really care about or think about, and even seemingly simple ones like height, they are influenced by many, 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 many different genes. You can't say that, oh, I have, do I have the tall gene?
Right.
It's just meaningless.
But so we brought ourselves up to about, as you imply, the level of high school biology, you know, what people sort of remember. We have a DNA, we pass it along. And I think that, you know, even if there's some complicated nonlinear map from the genes in our DNA to our traits, people still have this idea that basically there's a molecule, the DNA, and from the molecule, that's us. That just makes us, right? But we know a lot more than that now also, right? I mean, there's various ways in which the thing that we turn into is more than just what's encoded in our DNA in any straightforward way. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, when we, I mean, I it's funny, you know, like if you say to someone, oh, you have two eyes, you must have gotten your two eyes from your parents. They're going to look at you funny, like, what? That doesn't make sense. You know, and the fact is that you did get your two eyes from your parents. But when we talk about, oh, you got this, you got that from your parents, we're really more interested in the things that are different between people so that we can say like, oh, you are tall and your great uncle Bertie was tall. So you must have gotten it from him, even though, of course, Bertie is off to the side, whatever. Right. My point being that we just get kind of confused about what it is that we're talking about when we talk about these traits. And the fact is that, you know, you might be tall like your Uncle Bertie is tall. Sure, partly because of the genes you inherit. But, you know, maybe you and your Uncle Bertie also had the privilege of growing up in a affluent society, an affluent family. You had good diets. You got medicine when you were a kid. And so that you had the opportunity to grow to be tall. Because the fact is that, you know, all over the world, the average height of people is several inches higher than it was a century ago. And that's not because we are now inheriting a different set of genes. It's just that in that respect, the world got to be a better place. And so you have to sort of take into account the combined influences of genes and environment, or actually, as Shakespeare once called it, nature and nurture.
We'll get there. But I think that even at the level of nature, even at the level of our inheritance, our genetic inheritance, I'm learning about from your book, among other places, how complicated that is. For example, the idea of mitochondrial DNA, right? We have these little sort of genetic stowaways in every single one of our cells, and we hand them down to subsequent generations.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, even if you just limit yourself to genes, heredity can be a lot more complicated and strange than we learned about. So mitochondria, we have dozens or hundreds of them in every cell, and we depend on them for our survival. They're the little factories that generate fuel for our cell, using oxygen and various nutrients to build fuel that we then burn. They do lots of other stuff too. So
the powerhouse of the cell.
Yeah, absolutely. The weird thing about them, well, several weird things. One is that they've got their own DNA in them. That's aside from the DNA that's tucked away in the nucleus. So they've all got their own DNA. And if you look at a cell, you can actually watch mitochondria divide on their own, and they make new copies of their own DNA for those new daughter cells. And you might say, like, whoa, that doesn't make sense. That sounds like bacteria. And it's like, yeah, guess what? They're bacteria. Exactly. Like about 1.8 billion years ago, when we were single-celled, the ancestors of mitochondria somehow ended up inside of our cells in maybe some kind of symbiotic relationship, kind of like, you know, cleaner fish that go inside the mouths of bigger fish. And then they became basically permanent residents so that they couldn't live outside of our cells anymore. And as if that wasn't weird enough, when a sperm approaches an egg, it's swimming furiously, and it's using that mitochondria to generate that fuel to swim. So the only way it can get to an egg is to use its mitochondria, and then it reaches the egg, and it dumps in its chromosomes. Mm-hmm. But then it also destroys its own mitochondria. It just rips them apart.
So both the sperm and the egg have separate mitochondria from dad and mom.
Right. And the sperm do not deliver their mitochondria into the egg.
Lazy bastards.
Well, it's puzzling because, you know, when you look at our chromosomes, we are a 50-50 split between our parents. But you look at our mitochondria, it's all mom. It's just all mom.
So mitochondrial inheritance is not sexual reproduction.
Exactly. For some reason we keep out one of the parents from that process, and it's interesting because what that means is that, you know, your mitochondria is extremely similar to your mother's and your grandmother's and so on and so on and so on. Because, you know, with your chromosomes, in every generation, the pairs of chromosomes, they shuffle some of their DNA together.
Right.
And so they swap pieces in this process called meiosis. So after several generations, you know, your chromosome number two doesn't really look all that much like your great-great-great-great-grandmother's chromosome two. But mitochondria, basically the same. I mean, and so you, they're really powerful for tracing genealogy, for example. You know, you could, you can say like, aha, well, this person has to be the child of this woman. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And yeah, it's a, you know, scientists who are just looking at the basic questions about heredity are like, why is this? Why would the sperm not give the mitochondria? Why is it only the mothers? And, you know, there are some interesting theories about it. I mean, one theory is that if you have two batches of mitochondria inside a person coming from different people, they're going to not play well together, that they're going to operate differently, and that could actually cause problems.
I mean, that makes sense, right? When meiosis happens, meiosis is the splitting of this cell into a little sexual reproduction cell, right? So, you know, we split our genome in half, and then they're going to recombine with the half from the other parent, and the mitochondria kind of aren't participating in that process. So it's, you know, dad's mitochondria and mom's are just there separately, and they might come into conflict, like you say.
Right, right. There are, it's interesting, you know, we think of sort of mom and dad's genes as, you know, playing nicely in our own genome, but you know, there are conflicts between the genes in our parents, and evolutionary conflicts.
Sometimes there's conflicts between our actual parents too.
Yeah, and now think about it inside our DNA. There'll be like, you know, dad's genes are maybe sort of driving kids to grow faster because that's good for the father's long-term evolutionary benefit. The mother, meanwhile, if the mother has to carry, you know, the children, has to be pregnant, like too much growth is actually like can really drain her resources and may mean that she has fewer children over her lifetime. And so you will actually find that the man's copy of a gene is turned on, a woman's copy is turned off inside the child. It's like this tug of war going on. that finds the sort of optimal thing. And then sometimes you actually find, there are genes or pieces of DNA that basically just totally break Mendel's law completely and just, sort of override that sort of 50-50 kind of split between which chromosome ends up, you know, in an egg or a sperm. This was illustrated with a discovery once of certain kinds of flies, certain strains of flies where they would almost always produce daughters. Mm-hmm. And scientists are like, what's going on here? And it turned out that there was a gene that was basically was sitting on the, you know, on the female chromosome in flies and was sort of basically ensuring that these flies did not have any sons, because if they were just daughters, I would spread this gene further, sort of the ultimate selfish gene.
Well, this makes sense, right? I mean, maybe it makes sense. Maybe I'm leaping ahead too far, but we have this kind of game theoretic way of thinking about not just the struggle to survive as organisms, but we can, in the selfish gene way of thinking, think of it as the individual genomes trying to pass themselves down. And, you know, mom has a genetic set of information and so does dad, and they both want to win. And in human beings, in mammals, there's this rough equilibrium that we've reached where children are 50-50 male and female, but that's certainly not universal across the animal kingdom. There's a sort of different equilibria you might imagine reaching where the struggle plays out in different ways.
Sure. And actually there are some animals that adjust the ratio of their offspring just depending on what their environment kind of looks like.
Right.
So there are birds that, you know, in effect, what they're doing is looking around and saying like, I think I need a lot of daughters to stick around and to help me raise, you know, my other chicks. And voila, incredibly, they produce more daughters than sons. And then there are other situations where they produce more sons than daughters, you know, and then the sons fly off. So yeah, I mean, it's, we, you know, we like to think about, we like to take biology and put it into categories and try to come up with absolutes. So, you know, Mendel's observations become Mendel's law.
Yeah.
Or males and females become these sort of absolute categories that, you know, you could never have any exception to. I mean, we keep doing that. I think we just have very, you know, brains that really like categories, but, you know, heredity just does not work like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, there are some patterns that kind of repeat themselves a lot, but a lot of times those patterns are this sort of a stable balance produced by competition that sort of works out into this almost like a detente.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, I talked with Alice Dreger in episode 3 of the podcast, and we talked about intersexuality and how the fact that the idea there's two sexes, right? That's a convenient fiction. It's very useful. It's a good approximation. But if you're going to try to be a little bit more careful, there's a whole bunch of stuff in between and different ways you can be in between. And this reflects, I think that philosophically, this is just a really important point that you're bringing up, that we organize the world, we human beings, for our comprehension because it's easy for us. But as we try to be more and more accurate, all those complications are going to become more and more relevant to a better understanding.
Yeah, and I notice that a lot of times people will justify these absolute categories by saying like, well, look, like this is just nature, you know, this is yeah. Biology. You have to just accept biology. And I'm like, whoa, like you want to talk about biology? Let's take a little tour, shall we?
And through my 600-page book on inheritance.
absolutely. I mean, the fact is that heredity itself works very differently in a lot of different organisms. And, you know, the irony is that like, this is one reason why Mendel was forgotten actually. So this is one of these incredible ironies is that Mendel studied peas and he was like, oh my gosh, look at this mathematical thing that's happening. And he wrote to one of his mentors and his mentor's like, that's interesting. I'm not sure what to make of this, but why don't you see if you can replicate this? You know, like if this is what you say it is, then you ought to be able to find it in another plant, right? So Mendel, I guess, agreed with that. And he went and studied another common garden plant. And it turned out that this other one, hawkweed, I think, I forget the name now. It doesn't reproduce in the neat sort of sexual way that peas do. It has pollen. You know, pollen is sort of like the plant equivalent of sperm. And so they have male and female gametes, and they have, you have to have fertilization. But in these other plants, once fertilization happens, the ovules, the eggs, as it were, just basically just kick out any male DNA. They don't use it. So they do meiosis, you know, within their own genes. They're kind of like clones, except that they're sort of shuffling their DNA with every generation. So, you know, like, boom, like those lovely 3-to-1 patterns that Mendel saw with peas, they're just not there at all when he looks at another species. And then it's like, huh. And, you know, you imagine if he had picked another species that was very neat about very, you know, worked like peas did, that he might have gained more traction. But no, I mean, he was forgotten for basically 50 years.
It's good to know that the deflationary role of mentors has not changed in academia over the centuries. I think I've done that to my students sometimes. So I love the idea that our mitochondria, as important as they are, these stowaways, that, I mean, they're basically living their own lives, right? They're handing down their own genetic inheritance, and it's part of what makes us who we are and so forth. Are there other examples of that? I mean, I know that we carry around a whole microbiome, a whole set of little monocellular organisms that function in us. But my impression is that we kind of build those up throughout our lives. We don't actually get those from mom and dad.
Well, you know, that is a big question right now. And you know, there are people who are trying to really nail that down at the moment. Because it is true that you pick up microbes every day. You're picking them up off your keyboard and your doorknob, and you're shaking hands, or, you know, you're having yogurt. I mean, like, we're just swimming through a microbial ocean.
And but you don't mean me in particular. You mean all of the listeners out. It's not my keyboard that is worse than average, right?
Well, I've heard things. So the thing is that we also know that there are lots of species that pass down certain microbes as faithfully as they do their own genes. And my favorite example is cockroaches.
Okay.
So cockroaches actually depend on one species of bacteria to help them to eat food, because the bacteria can actually make some of the compounds they need for proteins out of their food. The cockroaches don't have the genes to do it. So they totally depend on these bacteria. And in fact, they actually build special little organs for these bacteria to live in. And the bacteria actually like embedded inside the cockroach's own cells in this organ. And when it comes time for the female to produce her eggs, something incredible happens. Some of these cells that carry these microbes, they just start crawling, and they make their way through the cockroach's body to the cockroach's eggs. And then they open up and they basically deliver these bacteria into the eggs. And so after these eggs get fertilized by a male cockroach, then the cockroach is born with these bacteria ready to go, just like we are with our mitochondria.
Biology is very scary.
It's mind blowing. And there, you know, the best book on all of this is Ed Young's book, I Contain Multitudes. Yeah. For me, what interests me in particular about this is to think about this as another form of heredity, another channel of heredity. It's like you've got your own genes, quote unquote, but then you have these bacteria.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have anything quite like that except for mitochondria that we know of.
That we know of.
But, right. But maybe there is something like heredity in the way that some of our bacteria end up inside of us. Scientists are trying to figure out, for example, are human embryos sterile when they're in the uterus? Like that, the evidence is not clear. Hmm. What is clear is that as a baby moves through the birth canal during delivery, it gets slathered in bacteria. And some of that bacteria goes into its gut, and there are certain forms of bacteria that the mother encourages to grow in the birth canal. And not only that, but the mother's milk contains bacteria as well as bacteria food. In other words, sugars that in the milk that babies can't digest themselves, but bacteria can. So there is a debate right now whether there might be certain species that are being put into babies early on and sort of are kind of define our own species that way.
It's a very romantic picture you are painting. The miracle of childbirth is so enhanced by our scientific understanding. It's really great.
Well, but it raises some very practical medical questions. You know, sure. Cesarean sections are exploding in countries like the United States, and so those babies are not getting that exposure, and so there's a question of like, well, does that matter? Can you still pick up those species just by being handled by your parents and other people, or does that not getting that seeding at the beginning, is that a problem? Because if your microbiome isn't quite right when you're young, that can lead to problems throughout your life. Your immune system may not work properly, for example.
Is it still thought to be true that the number of unicellular organisms in our microbiome is more cells than human cells in our body?
Actually, no.
I heard rumors that had gone away, that thought.
Yeah. So, and I and other people had, when we'd write about the microbiome, we'd always say, your microbes outnumber your own cells by 10 to 1, which, it's always fun to say.
It is.
It turns out probably not to be true. It's probably more like 1 to 1.
Okay.
So we have about 37 trillion cells of our own, or quote unquote own, human cells. Mm-hmm. There might be around the same, 30, 40 million bacteria. That doesn't count the viruses and the fungi and all the other fun critters that are living inside of us. So, the final number of the full microbiome might be higher, but it's not a 10 to 1 thing anymore.
But a body, a biological body, is a complicated open system. It's a ecosystem all by itself. We're a little bus that is carrying around a whole world of little critters talking to each other and evolving and doing their own things.
Yes, but it's not a totally random collection of critters.
Right.
Like the same species and the same strains tend to turn up again and again in people. And I mean, your microbiome is going to be different than mine, but not too differently, And so you can, if you look at human microbiomes compared to a chimpanzee's, they're going to be a lot more similar to each other than chimpanzees are. And it seems like we have filters.
Right.
So not everybody gets a seat in the bus.
And then there's also the idea that we're learning more and more that just the information in our DNA, even just getting back to the sort of genetic part of inheritance, there's more to it. There's more to how we pass information down. There's the whole story of epigenetics and so forth. I hear that you're advocating that people take epigenetic yoga classes so they can pass down new things that they learn to their children. Is that right?
Many people are saying that. Right. No, I'm...
I hear people saying it.
Yeah, right. No, I think you should take epigenetic yoga if you like it, but don't think that your kids are going to be better for it.
But the idea is that we can learn something and pass it down, right?
Yeah, that we could have an experience that alters how our genes work, and that alteration can get passed down to future generations. That's the crux of epigenetics and heredity. It's tricky, and I explore it in my book, and there's definitely good evidence for it happening in plants. It's good evidence for it happening in little teeny tiny worms.
Mm-hmm.
When you get to mice, there's some very tantalizing experiments. I mean, so for example, there's one experiment where scientists would expose male mice to a certain odor and then give them a shock. And then they learned to associate the odor with the shock. And then they took sperm from the mice and used it in vitro fertilization and then produced mouse pups. And it seems like the mice in the next generation kind of responded oddly to that same odor. And so the claim was that somehow that learned memory, that learned association about that smell got passed down to the mouse pups. And when that paper came out, the journal put Lamarck on the cover.
Remind us who Lamarck is, Mr. Lamarck.
Mr. Lamarck. Lamarck was a French biologist who preceded Darwin. He was most active in the early 1800s. and came up with his own theory of evolution, which depended a lot on what's known as the inheritance of acquired traits. So he had a classic example that, you know, giraffes stretch their neck to reach leaves. There's some sort of nervous fluid that causes their necks to get a little bit longer. You can think about it that like building up muscles, and then those giraffes would pass down that longer neck to their descendants, and so then over many generations, the giraffes would adapt to their environment by getting a longer neck. And so, you know, the claim, I guess, is that, well, mice, you know, are adapting to their environment by learning about, you know, the risks that they face, and that their offspring are inheriting that knowledge.
Right.
So that's the basic idea.
And how would this work sort of at the molecular level for the mice? Is it pups? You call them mice pups, mice babies, or puppies?
Pups.
Okay.
They're pups.
I learned something. Yeah. So it's a matter of, obviously, the DNA are not being altered. As you smell something, your DNA is still your DNA. But somehow there's information being passed down to the next generation that is not in the DNA. It's somehow in the chemical makeup of what goes into making a little puppy.
if you call a mouse puppies at a biology conference, people will probably look at you funny.
You think the people will see through me and not realize I'm not a biologist?
There's an imposter in our ranks as a cosmologist. Get him out. We know that genes are attended to by lots of molecules in the cell. You know, genes just don't take care of themselves.
Right.
And so there are proteins, for example, that will clamp on to genes, and they can essentially shut them down. There are other places that proteins latch on to DNA, and they can switch on a gene. You can coil DNA around spools, and then basically anything that gets coiled up, any gene just can't be used to make a protein because it's just all tucked away. And those changes can be very long lasting. Like when a cell divides, those same controls will in effect be inherited by the two new cells. So that's why your skin cells, when they divide, they make skin cells. They don't, you know, make brain cells or tooth cells or something, you know, like it. So we know that epigenetics really matters a lot. There's no question about that. And so the question is, could these kinds of processes, you know, change the way that genes are being used? And then could those changes, you know, those proteins and those coils or whatever, get passed down through the generations? We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
The mechanism for it, it's especially for mammals, it's kind of hard to figure out how the mechanism would actually work. And you look at a mouse experiment. I mean, the critics of this kind of research have said, like, whoa, so you're telling me that there's this change that is happening in the mouse's brain, the daddy mouse's brain, and that somehow then that is getting communicated into daddy mouse's sperm. And then somehow that is then making its way through fertilization, through the development of an embryo, through the development of a brain. And then somehow it's getting plugged into back into the brain in the same circuits that daddy had being altered. And a lot of scientists just say, like, whoa, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Right. But this is something that's being studied. We'll try to figure it out.
Yeah, but in the meantime, there's epigenetic yoga. Like, you know, there are literally like psychiatrists who will help you to undo the epigenetic trauma that your grandparents passed down to you. Like, this has totally saturated pop culture. And I don't honestly know how it happened because, you know, epigenetics is messy and complicated and the language is totally inscrutable. And yet, you know, when I give talks, like half the questions I get after the talks are, what about epigenetics?
Look, I'm writing a book about quantum mechanics, so the idea that crazy abstract ideas are going to be hijacked by popular culture is not foreign to me.
any tips?
Well, quantum epigenetic yoga might be a bestseller, right?
Oh, there you my go. God. Right? With, that's
throw,
it.
Throw dark
that's
energy it. In there, and we'll be buying yachts any moment. So
okay, we need to patent that idea right now.
Okay.
Author the book this week.
I will edit this out of the podcast so no one hears it and steals our great idea. It sounds like, though, even in principle, if you handed a computer a complete list of the 3 billion base pairs in our DNA, the GCTA letters in our alphabet, a computer with perfect knowledge, that would not be enough to predict what the organism would look like. I mean, it would be missing the mitochondrial DNA. It would be missing all sorts of chemical signals that could be passed down through the body. But I mean, so it sounds like we're learning how much of the organism is predicted by that. Probably a lot, right? But certainly not the whole thing.
Yeah, and in a way, this is one of those deep questions in the history of biology. You know, how much of an organism is basically determined at the very beginning, and how much of an organism's end result is just the emergence through development, you know, through and you know, it, you know, as always, the answer is both, but it's complicated, you know, in the sense that there are a lot of things that you can predict based on DNA. Those predictions are not like, you know, I can't like predict what color shoes you're wearing right now today, based on your DNA, Sean, but I bet if I looked at your DNA, I could get a pretty good idea what your eye color is. Mm. And I might be able to, you know, make some very crude predictions about the influence of your genes on your height. I couldn't tell you how tall you are, because I don't know if your parents, you know, fed you properly.
Right.
But, you know, there are things that you can predict out of DNA. But then there's this, you know, the DNA makes, you know, the cells make proteins and RNA molecules from the genes, and the cells are talking to each other, and they're taking in cues from the environment. Cells are migrating through the body, and all sorts of crazy stuff is happening, and all the genes are responding to all of that, and that is how we end up the way we are. So yeah, so, you know, if someone, you know, I had my genome sequenced, I'm sure nobody could make any predictions about me from that.
Yeah, right. I do want to, that's right, I remember this from the book. So when you say you had your genome sequenced, so like you're special here because you really had the full blown treatment. If people do ancestry.com or 23andMe or any of these things, they get a little bit of information about their genome, but they do not get a list of 3 billion ACGTs, right? I mean, they get some sub knowledge of that. Do you actually have a printout of, you know, all 3 billion base pairs in your DNA?
I do not have a printout. I have a hard drive.
Okay. Metaphorical. Yeah. I was being metaphorical.
Yeah. Well, if I printed it out, it would, you know, fill up, you know, dozens and dozens of books. I mean, that would be a fun art project, but
you can use a small font. It's okay.
Yeah, right. And it would be kind of hard to, you know, do a search function
That's
on
true.
That. So I prefer to have it on that hard drive, because then I can take it to scientists and say, like, okay, you know, let's play around with this data here, which just so happens to be my genome, and show me how you discover things in human genomes by analyzing this sort of data. And it's been a fascinating experience, but it is a very different thing than getting your DNA sequence from a place like 23andMe. What 23andMe or Ancestry does is they do something called genotyping. So basically, they look at maybe a million markers, a million spots in throughout your genome. And they try to, they look at, say, well, which variant do you have at that particular spot? And so it's, you know, it's kind of a high level survey of your genome, but you can learn an awful lot. One of the reasons you can learn an awful lot is because we pass we tend to like share similar stretches of DNA. So if you've got, you know, a string of variants all in a row, chances are that that whole segment of DNA is identical to somebody else that has those same variants.
Right.
And so you can kind of, you can infer a lot about what's in between those markers. When you get your whole genome sequence, that means that you're trying to figure out as best as you can every single letter in your genome. And that, with that, you can discover all sorts of deeper things about your genome.
Well, and one of the deeper things you could discover is that you are susceptible or even almost inevitably going to have some disease that might affect you at a certain time of your life. And so there's this question of, what do we want to know? Like, if you could, the philosophers would come in and instantly say, the version of the question to ask is, if you could know you were going to die on exactly a certain day, would you want to know that? Is that information you want? Some much cruder version of that might be available through this, looking at our genomes.
That information is really only available to a small fraction of the people who get their DNA genotyped or get their genome sequenced, because the genes that really have a strong impact on your health, let's say, we're talking about genes that cause Huntington's disease or genes that raise your risk dramatically of getting early onset Alzheimer's, genes that dramatically raise your risk of getting certain forms of cancer, these are rare.
Right.
Natural selection is not fond of these genes.
For obvious reasons.
So therefore they're rare. And so, when I got my genome sequenced, the first part of it was doing it at, I did it as part of a conference. And I think there were like 40 people who were going to this conference who also got their genome sequenced. They weren't getting the raw data, but they were getting these interpretations from clinical geneticists. And there were like 40 of us. And if I recall correctly, maybe like five people were told like, okay, we're going to sit down with a genetics counselor and make some plans for you to talk to your doctor because there's something you need to know about.
How's your life insurance plan looking?
Yeah, right. I mean, for the rest of us, it was like, you don't have anything that really jumps out, is what they would say. There's nothing where it's like, hey, that gene, that's big trouble. Now, I have plenty of genes that have been associated with, raising my risk of this disease or that by some modest amount. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to die of any of those diseases. I mean, I also have variants that lower the risk for certain diseases too. And that is going to be how most people are going to find when they get their DNA sequenced. And it's going to be, I'm concerned that people not make one of two mistakes. One mistake is to be like sort of angry and irritated that they didn't find anything in their genome. It's like, really? Like,
my genome is much more interesting than you're making it out to be. Yes.
Well, like this isn't like a status thing. Like, it's not like you want to go to the doctor's office and get terrible news, and like, it's not like you feel like you should feel happy if they say, oh, you're fine. Yeah. See you later. The flip side of that is that sometimes people will get in these reports or maybe do their own research and discover they have a gene that is associated with some disease, like, let's just say like colon cancer. And they say, oh my God, that's it. I'm going to die of colon cancer. Like, no. You have to dig down that extra level and say like, well, what exactly did this study find? Did it find that like people who had this variant had, a slightly higher risk of this disease?
Yeah.
And also like, how big was the study? Like if a lot of these studies, when they're preliminary, it's just like 100 people. They're tiny, and tiny studies are often wrong. And so there are plenty of mutations that were thought originally to cause diseases that we now know do not. So, you know, you got to think about all these things when you're looking at these results. And that's kind of gets back to me and my how I feel that like our high school, grade school genetics has just got to step up its game, because these things are not just abstractions that you learn about in high school and never think about again. People are getting these results in their email inbox.
Right. But also, isn't it maybe an antiquated kind of worry? Because recently I bought new running shoes. So I went to the Nike website and they let you actually customize your own shoes, like, you know, what color is the front and what logo is on the bottom and stuff like that. So within a couple of generations, we'll have a website for doing that for our babies, right? We'll just be able to pick what different features we want them to have, edit the DNA, and get whatever baby we want.
I am sure that there will be people who are offering that if the laws allow. You know, I don't think that you will get the baby of your dreams. I think your baby will just be your baby and will be subject to all the vagaries of experience and biology and all the rest of it. But, you know, we already have all sorts of companies out there that are offering really dubious claims based on looking at your DNA. You know, they'll look at a few variants and they'll say, aha, like, here's your special, you know, exercise program, or here's your special DNA diet, or just, there's even a company that called Vinome. I don't know if you've seen them.
No.
They will recommend wine to you based on your DNA.
No, sorry, how do you spell that? I actually have to look this up. What is this?
Yeah, please do. Vinome. Vinome.
All right. Could be a podcast sponsor down the road. I like it.
Well, yeah. You may not want to play this episode because, I mean, when I saw a video for it, I just thought, well, is this The Onion? This can't be real. But it was. You know, like, I mean, all these companies seem to be doing, as far as I can tell, is, you know, looking in the scientific literature and saying, like, you know, here's a variant where people who had it tended to report a stronger sensation for bitter tastes than people who didn't.
Right.
And then going from that to saying, like, here, take this Pinot Noir. You know, with exercise, it's a very similar thing. I mean, yeah, sure, there are genes that are associated with all sorts of aspects of exercise. You know, the power in your muscles or how much oxygen you take in and so on. And I'm sure that, like, there is a genetic element to great athletes being great. But, you know, when I got my genome sequenced, the company that gave me that first sort of first layer of results before I took matters into my own hand, they actually said, like, your muscles are built for power. And I was like,
sorry, I did not mean to laugh. I was laughing at something completely separate that was happening here in the room.
I'm sure. No, it's okay, Sean. Yeah, like, I mean, you've met me, and I mean, like, anybody who's met me knows that my muscles are not built for power. I mean, it's just not the case. You know, but what they were doing is they were just looking at this one variant and these limited number of studies and not taking into account all the other genes that influence our muscles, many of which we don't really understand. So, yeah, I do worry about, you know, letting folks like that who run these companies do the same thing with you know, designing babies.
Well, tell us a little bit, though, about CRISPR and the reality of gene editing. It is something that is rushing at us very, very quickly, right?
Yeah. I mean, I only became aware of CRISPR maybe 6 years ago or something. And I can remember thinking, I mean, at first I was sort of puzzled by it because actually CRISPR it's a natural thing. What it is it's basically an immune system for bacteria. They make molecules that can essentially store information about viruses and then use that information to create new molecules that could zero in on particular stretches of virus DNA and cut it. And I thought, wow, that's cool. I mean, microbes never cease to amaze me. but then some scientists said, well, we could use that. And we could maybe cut whatever DNA we want. And lo and behold, they could. They could zero in on particular stretches of DNA and make cuts and then substitute in new DNA. And all of a sudden, they had this very powerful new molecular tool at their disposal. You know, scientists use CRISPR all the time now to do experiments. You know, they might say, like, we want to know, you know, which cell, we want to know, you know, which genes in a cancer cell are essential for it to survive as a cancer cell. So they would just use CRISPR to systematically cut out every single gene in individual cell lines and just see which ones survive as cancer. You just couldn't do that before. I mean, So the impact is unbelievable. And then people are starting to say, like, well, can we use this to alter the genes of crops or of animals? And the answer is, hell yeah.
Sure.
And so the next step is, well, what can we do for people? And one of the things you can potentially do for people is treat hereditary diseases. So if someone has sickle cell anemia, you take some of their bone marrow cells out, these stem cells that can make blood. You tweak their DNA so that they can now make hemoglobin that they need, you know, the proper kind of hemoglobin, because sickle cell anemia is caused by a misshapen kind of hemoglobin. And you put the cells back into people and they make healthy blood cells. That's the hope. And there are clinical trials that could start very soon on that. And then the big frontier, the one that you know, understandably everybody gets excited and scared about, is what if you could use these on embryos and change genes in embryos, and then you are creating an inherited change that will be passed down through the generations.
Right. Yeah, they're going to do it, right? I have a kind of an extremist point of view on this, because people raise this question that you just raised, you know, can we genetically edit what's going on in an embryo and therefore change what the person is going to be like? And there's a sort of instant reluctance, right? It's like, well, of course, that would be bad, or at least it might be bad. We should think about it and we should, you know, really be very careful. But I'm not quite sure where the reluctance comes from, other than a sort of squickiness, right? A sort of feeling that we're messing with nature. And what I suspect is that some people will feel that way. Some people will not feel that way. And it's absolutely 100% going to happen. And 100 years from now, the idea of just making a baby by randomly picking half of the DNA from mom and half the DNA from dad and hoping for the best will seem hopelessly barbaric.
Well, you know, you and I are going to have to, you know, hope that you know, life extension, anti-aging drugs advance really quickly so that we can make a bet and see if it pans out, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I have thought about these scenarios a lot. Partly they're just fun to think about. And you know, it's what science fiction writers do so well. You know, I there are a lot of questions I have. I mean, I'm not as sanguine, maybe is the word, as you are, like, in the sense that, so for starters, like CRISPR, CRISPR is indeed revolutionary, but, it's turning out to have some problems. People call it gene editing, but it's editing that involves chopping DNA. And that right. is a pretty radical thing to do to DNA. And cells don't like it. I mean, the cells actually have all sorts of defenses against chopping up DNA because it can lead to all sorts of damage that can ultimately cause a cell's descendants to become cancerous, for example. There are concerns about just how safe CRISPR would be in terms of like creating a line of cells you'd want to put in your body through CRISPR. Like, you don't want to put in cells that are going to be more prone to cancer. That's problem right. number one. Problem number two, there's a recent study that showed that sometimes when scientists try to cut one particular segment of DNA out, they cut out a long stretch that includes that particular target. And so you might be cutting out pieces of DNA that you really need. And maybe that when the DNA is getting repaired, it gets kind of shuffled around in ways that could be a problem. So there's the safety issue. And then also there's kind of like the logistics issue, you know, like, you know, if you're saying, I mean, you know, you're saying like, oh, this is barbaric. So you're imagining a world where, are you imagining a world where all, say, 9 billion people, all get in vitro fertilization? You know, I mean, in vitro fertilization is a very difficult, drawn out process right now. It could get a lot better in the future, but, you know, maybe not. Maybe there are some inherent sort of limits to this. It's not. So my point is, like, CRISPR alone would not deliver you into that science fiction future. You'd have to have all sorts of other advances in reproductive technology and stem cell research and all the rest of it before this could even be possible. But I have talked to biologists who say, you know, we're gonna look at CRISPR like vaccination in the future.
Right. Yeah. So I think I get absolutely the fact that it's not within the next 5 years or 10 years, right? We will have to extend our lives if we're going to see this thing come true. And I'm also not sanguine in the sense that I think that it's going to be an unalloyed good. I look at, you know, this editing of our children's genomes as it's a technology. It's like cars or Twitter, right? There's going to be good parts about it or bad parts about it. I just think it's inevitable. I just think that it's like we have jumped off of a pier into the ocean. And as we fall in, we're debating, should we get wet or not? And that's just not a debate that is very reasonable to have. We can have other debates. Should we swim for shore? Should we try to climb back up the pier? Should we fight off the sharks? But I think it's going to happen. And, you know, people are going to be trying to alter their children's intelligence and skin color and size of their noses and everything. And I think that we're kind of dropping the ball a little bit on dealing with what the implications of that really are going to be.
Well, I mean, I guess the question becomes, you know, if people really are going to try to do this, if they can, then, you know, should we pass laws to prevent that? Or do we put regulations in place to allow certain uses of it for certain things? And then really you shifting from a scientific question to a social or a political one. You know, for example, we're dealing with that right now, actually. I mean, people don't realize it, but, you know, genetically engineering humans has already begun we were talking about mitochondria before. Like, mutations can cause mitochondria to become defective. And so women can pass down defective mitochondria to their children, and you can get these mitochondrial diseases, which can be quite devastating. And there are all sorts of different ones that emerge from faulty mitochondria. So some years ago, people thought, well, what if we were to do a transplant, an egg transplant, take the DNA in the nucleus of an egg and put it into a donor egg that has good mitochondria in it? Obviously, you take out the nuclear DNA out of the egg, donor egg first. But anyway, so basically, now you have an egg that has the mother's nuclear DNA, the chromosomes, and another woman's mitochondria, and then fertilize that. People call that three-parent babies, which is unfortunate, but it's stuck. Anyway, we can debate about what it means to be a parent. But in any case, in the United States, that has been banned. I mean, there's no way that's going to happen in the United States. There's no way there's going to be research or evaluation of it. Forget it. That is dead in the water right now. There was a case of a doctor in New York who had done some research on this, who actually went to Mexico to treat a couple who the mother had a mitochondrial disease. And so Mexico doesn't have any laws one way or the other about it. And so they did it kind of secretly. But meanwhile, in Britain, they talked about this quite explicitly. They had discussions in Parliament, and they said, you know what? These diseases are so devastating, and we feel that, this combination of mitochondria from one woman and chromosomes from another woman, we're okay with that. We don't think that violates sort of human dignity, and we're going to allow this to go forward under a lot of regulation. And so there's a university in Britain that has gotten a license. They're open for business, and so they will start. Probably babies will start being born soon through this technology. So, I wonder, what's going to happen with CRISPR?
Right.
Will it be the American version, total ban? Will it be the Mexico version? Like, it's all kind of on a, unregulated black market? Or is it going to be out in the open, carefully, explicitly regulated, under the guidance of government?
Well, and I think I'm being a little intentionally provocative here, because I think that there's a tendency for people either to just sort of ask rhetorical questions and leave them hanging without quite answering them, or there's this other tendency, which we in the United States love so much, is just to ban it first and ask questions later. For something like designer babies, if it does become possible, and obviously there's enormous scientific technical hurdles to getting there. But, I could easily imagine that it's banned here. And so, someone sets up a clinic in Mexico or the Cayman Islands or whatever, and rich people go there and design their babies and poor people can't do it. Or even if it doesn't get banned anywhere, like you alluded to earlier, there's just, you can do it. It costs $1 million, right? That's just how much the effort is going to require. And so that's a kind of inequality socially that is going to be hard to deal with. It's a little bit, it hits home in a way, the ability to make sure all your children are, tall and beautiful, that other kinds of inequality might not.
I have a problem with these arguments against CRISPR based on inequality, because mm-hmm. they all make it sound like we are living in a paradise of equality today.
We're not.
if you are concerned about inequality, like it's time to get started now, because it's not as if genes are the only thing that can influence the success of children later in life, so. This raises, I do think that this also raises difficult questions, because, if you say, it's wrong to let parents use CRISPR to make their children, let's say, tall and beautiful, or whatever you want to dream that you could do with CRISPR. I don't think that would happen, but let's just pretend you could do mm-hmm. that. Anyway. So what about all the other advantages that children of wealthy parents have that help them to get ahead in life? Do we make those illegal? Should SAT prep classes be banned?
Yeah, no, I think this is very real, but I still think the analogy is not quite perfect. I mean, I get it, and I think that we are a terrible society at treating people equally right now. That point is very, very well taken. But in America, at least, people grow up with this idea that someday, no matter where you come from, you could be a millionaire, you could be president. But no one grows up with the idea that, 20 years from now, my DNA will be better. So there's it's this kind of obvious in your face difference between people, which I suspect people will react to very viscerally.
I agree. And I mean, I think part of it is that, well, you know, part of the problem here is that we think of genes as being the sort of absolute definition of who we are. It's not. Yeah. But we also think about heredity in the sense that like these kids will then pass down these traits to their kids and so on. And that really like strikes a chord, I think, because like I was saying before, like heredity is such a profound thing to us in terms of how we define ourselves. And so to be tampering with heredity seems like one of the great transgressions. And that I think colors our discussion of this. And you can see this, and you know, in the debates people have, you know, scientists who developed CRISPR actually have just in the past few years like had a series of international meetings to figure out like, well, what's right, what's wrong, what should we do with this? And the overriding issue, it seemed, was what is this going to do to heredity? Mm-hmm. And which is so striking to me, because it really tells you where our concerns are located. I think it's a good question, but you know, on the other hand, I mean, some people say like, oh, we're going to turn ourselves into two separate species. You know, you'll have the rich people who can afford CRISPR who will become their own species, and the poor people will become a different species. And so it reminds me of, you know, the time machine.
It's very H.G. Wells. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But you know, like, but people, but like that just, people just don't work that way. Like animals in general don't work that way. Like you like people have sex, lots of sex. And like people don't respect these sort of arbitrary boundaries when they're having sex. Yeah. Like, whatever genes might get introduced into some rich person will either disappear entirely from the human gene pool eventually, because that's what happens to most gene variants, or will just kind of diffuse around all over the world after a while because of just the way that people have kids together. So you know, I just find some of these science fiction scenarios that people are talking about as if they're like real ethical questions to be silly, frankly.
I think actually, so I'm gonna go on the other side. I think that even if they're wildly unrealistic and not mapping out the future, I'm glad people are envisioning the craziest, most extreme scenarios. I think it will help us sort of be prepared a little bit for the brave new world yet to come.
Well, but you have to then, but. Okay, we can talk about these scenarios, but then we have to take the next step and say like, well, okay, but here are the basic facts of science that tell you that this is not even something worth considering, you know?
Sure.
You know, like for example, like I wrote an article for the Times recently about studies on DNA and the link between genes and how long you stay in school. There is a connection there. We don't really know why there's a connection there. It may have to do with genes that influence certain things in our brains or maybe even our parents' brains. We don't know. But there's an association there. It's interesting. It's worth studying. And you can actually like look at, you know, these million variants in people's DNA and actually come up with a score, a sort of education score, which sounds very fancy, like, oh, well, I could use that to, you know, test some kindergartner and say like, you're never going to make it to college. So we're just going to put you over here in this track and, you know, you just be content with your lot. And that would be a ridiculous thing to do because this score, you know, it only predicts a small amount of the variation in how people do in school. So chances are that your score would be very wrong. So, you know, lots of people with a high genetic score who drop out early from school. There are a lot of people with a low genetic score who go into grad school. Like it's just one variable among several. So, you know, for people to say like, oh, okay, well, clearly we're going to have this future where everybody's fate is predetermined. Well, no, and it's it's not a scenario worth talking about just because of the basic statistics of what we're talking about. So, yeah. You know, I'm all for talking about scenarios, but you have to be willing to throw some out.
No, I completely agree on that. I mean, that idea that you just said about sort of predicting people's educational attainments on the basis of their DNA makes no sense to me. It's like taking a preseason power poll in some sports league and then saying, well, we don't need to play the games now. We figured out who's going to win. But playing the games actually matters also. So Carl Zimmer, or as we say around here, Carl Built for Power Zimmer, thank you very much for a wonderful conversation. It's always great to talk to you.
Oh, it was good talking to you again, Sean.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.